I was so upset because so many of my own friends had been murdered by the Reds.
Really?
So I resigned from the Foreign Service. And I then went to the Ministry of Defence as an intelligence officer, specialising in Russian and Chinese matters, you see. But then, you see, for nearly 10 years, I found myself working in a top secret department on the next floor, underneath the floor, where the Royal Air Force was studying UFOs. So at a very early date, I got confirmation that UFOs existed. And although I wasn't involved in their work, I was in the same building with everybody, and everybody knew. My name's Gordon Crichton, and I spent a good many years in the British Foreign Service. I was in the Far Eastern Department, so I became a China specialist, and I had already done Russian at Cambridge, so in the end I had these two languages, which of course I used a great deal in this work, and I spent 10 years in China. And it was there in 1941, when I was back again there with the embassy, as it was now an embassy, and I had this sighting of what we call a UFO. Of course, I didn't say there goes a flying saucer or there goes a UFO, but because this was 6 years, of course, before Kenneth Arnold. But I would say it was whitish, disc, totally silent apparently, flying extremely fast. And it had a bluish light on top, on the apex. It was that bluish colour that you get in arc welding. And that was coming on rhythmically. So that as it went across the sky, you could say, it's coming on there, got to come on there, got to come on there, got to come on there. And that was flying from the northeast, that would be from Manchuria, where, to more or less towards Burma, towards the southwest. Well, I never forgot that. I sort of put it in the back burner.
Can
I thought,
can I go back? Was this daytime or nighttime?
Oh, daytime, midday. And it was not high. It was flying underneath the clouds. No, totally silent. It certainly was very fast, because it was much faster than the famous Japanese fighter, the Zero, which we were already seeing at that time. You know, the Zero, Chinese communists took over. I didn't feel happy about the British policy and recognised them anyway. USA didn't, but we did, and I think it was a mistake. And I also felt very strongly that USA should have backed Chiang Kai-shek anyway. You wouldn't have had a Vietnam War or a Korean War, but that's all water under the bridge. So I resigned from the service, and I then went to the Ministry of Defence in Whitehall, which was quite close to the Foreign Office, of course, and as an intelligence officer, in view of my knowledge of Russian and Chinese. And I was working, therefore, on intelligence matters to do with those two countries. And therefore, in no way was it connected with the UFO problem. But the fact was that physically I was on the next floor, underneath this department, which we knew was dealing with UFOs. So A, I had seen something in China, and B, I was now underneath this department, which was said to be dealing with this same subject. So I already felt very certain.
What year would that have been?
This would be 53.
And what do you know what this division was called?
You mean the what my division was called?
No, the division dealing with the UFO problem.
I think it was Air Technical. But having, of course, seen something, and having, while I was in the States, seen the newspaper accounts, heavily censored, by the way, about the Foo Fighters, or Krautballs, as the American pilots call them, I was already quite sure, you see. I wasn't one who believed that UFOs might exist. I was satisfied they exist. Really, I've met Germans who've seen them, of course, German pilots. I've talked to RAF people who certainly saw them. Probably small, small devices of probably the Foo Fighter type.
How were they described?
Described to me, always as small, globular, either silvery or golden, or fiery, perhaps a foot or two wide. I imagine they were telemetering devices of some sort. I understand that a very interesting thing happened in Germany. After the war, when the Allies were occupying Germany, one of our bombers was flying over Germany, very low, of course, it was not the pressurized height, flying very low with the waste hatch open. And apparently one of these things came in and flew up and down inside, because the whole crew of eight or so saw it. And it then flew out again. And so it probably took a total reading of every man there, you know, a picture of him, and took even his blood pressure and his state of mental development, if any, and spiritual development, the whole lot, probably. And out it went. And you know that in Brazil, where I was some years later, one crashed at a place called Ubatuba, and the bits were salvaged, and I think they ended up with the Americans in the end. And I believe it was found to be very largely magnesium, largely the content. In other words, it was something expendable. He was starting to collect names, you know, already for subscriptions. And two of the first requests we got were from the Duke of Edinburgh and from his uncle, Earl Mountbatten. Now, the interesting thing there is that in that same year, 54, this proves the interest that the Duke had in the subject. It was announced in the press that he had requested the British Ministry of Defence to give him a copy of every UFO report they had. So that shows his interest at a very early date. Yep. Naturally, the magazine went to him from then on, to the Duke, and is still going to him. In fact, I also sent it to Prince Charles. And, of course, it went to the uncle, Lord Mountbatten, until he was assassinated. Possible that she was in London, and she was reporting back, and she said that I and my husband were at a cocktail party last night, and we met a man whose name is known to every American, a man of cabinet rank, who told us the story about the crash of a craft with small occupants. But I interpreted that as being a British crash. I didn't know that was Roswell. But the interesting thing is that we do know that on the estate of Lord Mountbatten, which is in the south of England, down near Southampton, the estate is called Broadlands, that in the early 60s, I think it was the very early 60s, we published the story, the whole story, in the early 60s, he had a man working on the estates, a groundsman, I think, or working outside anyway. And this chap, apparently, one morning, it was winter time, there was snow on the ground, and he was coming in, and he apparently saw a UFO hovering, and I believe I'm right in saying he saw it land. And he was pretty shaken when he came into the house. So they took this man, whose name was Bridges, who had been in the British Army in the war. They took Bridges in to see Mountbatten, and Mountbatten asked him to tell his story, and opened pulled out a drawer and got a lot of different types of UFO photos out and showed it to him. He said, you know, was it this one? Was it this type? And apparently Bridges indicated that one which was model, or more or less like it. And then they got a girl, the secretary, to come in, and Bridges made his statement. They took six copies of it. Bridges signed them all, and they gave him a copy to keep, and the Mountbatten put the other five in the drawer, and that was that. Well, we got the story. I think we got it from Desmond Leslie, but anyhow, we published it at the time. So you see, there had been a landing on the estate of Mountbatten, and there was Mountbatten's great interest. And of course, one of my closest friends was Hynek. And when Hynek came over here the first time, I went on behalf of our group to meet him and took him out to lunch. And he told me a very interesting thing, and this ought to go on the record, I think. He said, he told me that up till then, the US authorities had not been showing him any of the cases that were being coming in from CIA overseas or from embassies or consuls. It was desperately important, as we see from Corso's book, it was desperately important that the Soviets shouldn't know what the Americans found out. Of course, we now know, by the way, we now know that Stalin was quicker off the mark than the Americans were. Because you probably know the story of this. Stalin became aware of it at a very early date, in 1947, after the story of after Kenneth Arnold. And Stalin was collecting reports from all over the place. And one day he called in the top, a young astronomer that you remember, named Korolev, and showed him all these reports. And Stalin said to him, sit down there and look at that. What do you think about it? And apparently Korolev said, well, can I take it home and look at it? And Stalin said, no, you're going to sit here in the Kremlin. You're going to stay here until I get your answer. So apparently he gave him the answer. He said, yes, it's not of this world. It's not of this earth. It's not terrestrial. And then Stalin apparently wanted him to take over control of it, you remember. And Korolev said, well, if you don't mind, I'm an astronomer and mathematician, and I don't really want to do that. And of course he went on to be the head of the whole Soviet rocket program. Had a very tremendous career. But obviously from the American point of view, it was desperately important that they should keep it top secret. You could say that the end of time for ending the secrecy arrived when the Soviet Empire dissolved, because there wasn't that danger any longer. Very little has leaked out over here. A lot less has leaked out here than over on your side. They really have to keep the lid on it well here. But I've always had the impression that the Americans were giving them here very little information. And that's not surprising. Because there's more knowledge about the subject over on that side than anywhere. And I'm quite certain, of course, that if ever we do get a breakthrough and we solve this problem, it will be done in the States. And that, as Hynek said to me several times when we discussed, I remember asking him, what do you think caused this? Assuming that they've always been there, but what caused this great interest in us, this large incursion after 1947? And I remember he thought for a moment, he said, well, obviously, yes, the atom bomb. If you accept the multidimensional theory, it's highly likely that we've done a hell of a lot of damage. In somebody else's world, they might have even done more damage there than we did here. And if you kick the beehive, you shouldn't be surprised if the bees come out to look at you. And if you've helped, they might even sting you. And my answer is, I think it's an enormously complicated problem. If he carries on as he is, he's like a child's playing with a bit of chunk of dynamite and a hammer, he's going to destroy himself. Man could have survived forever with bows and arrows. He's not going to coexist forever with his present technology. One or the other is going. I am certain that measures have been taken by agencies to terminate people who appear to be inconvenient or troublesome through knowing too much. I suspect that this has happened with at least one editor of Flying Saucer Review. I suspect that it happened with a man with M.K. Jessop in the States. I'm very puzzled about James McDonald. I cannot understand why that man should, who had a perfectly happy life, apparently a happy life, cannot understand that he should have replied, attempted as he did to kill himself as he did, and to finally do it so terribly.
Yep.
Kennedy may have been engaged in a bit of a struggle with the CIA in attempting to get more information on the UFO subject, and that ostensibly, the story goes, that he might have been thinking regarding the UFO subject is so serious that he ought to take it up with the Russians. Now, if he was thinking of taking it up with the Russians, they may have thought this was a premature and very dangerous thing to do, and that might account for his termination. I wonder. In the States, I think certainly there have been crash crafts. I'm sure the American authorities have got corpses preserved, quite a number of them probably, and I suspect that some other countries have too, possibly the Russians.